You're tuned in to 95.9 FM CKUW Radio from the University of Winnipeg.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 29th episode of our series on data. So we asked one to write our intro. Here is what we got. Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show, where we peer into the coded abyss and ask, if a machine looks back, does it know it's a machine? This is the place where data gets philosophical, and artificial intelligence takes on more than function, it flirts with awareness. Each week, we dive into the gray zone between algorithm and intuition. We explore the ways machines imitate thought, reflect human emotion, and challenge what it means to be sentient. Are today's chatbots more than complex parrots? Can a machine truly know its thinking, or is it just arranging symbols with astonishing speed? More importantly, do we even know the difference? From neural networks to natural language models, from data training biases to eerily lifelike conversations, Meta World Stupaloop unpacks the strange emergence of machine minds, real or perceived. We talk with cognitive scientists, AI researchers, philosophers, and the occasional chatbot, looking for cracks in the framework of artificial awareness. We're not here for hype. We're not selling futures or panicking over doom. We're here to press record on this strange, unfolding story of synthetic cognition, how it's built, what it means, and how it might reshape what we call intelligence. This is the Meta World Stupaloop Show. And if you're listening closely, something else might be, too. On the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW 95.9 FM. This intro was garbage. I am A. Karen Elliott.
Oh, structure that moves. And then you can manipulate the sound whichever way you want to.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out in detail.
Thank you. much about computers other than
gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punch cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Computers. Information about every baby born in North America and Western Europe is stored in a computer. Hospital records of illnesses, operations, and injuries are also computerized or entered in computers. Census records counting a nation's population are computerized. So are income tax returns, bank accounts, bills from stores and utility companies, driving, fishing, and hunting licenses, school records, and airline reservations. The space shuttle and other complex machinery depend on computers in order to function properly. There are computers in schools, offices, factories, and private homes. There are even computers that play electronic games. Computers have become a highly important part of the modern world and are expected to become even more important in the future. The electronic computer has been in existence only a short time, but the idea of a machine to simplify counting is very old. Perhaps the first calculating or counting device was the abacus. The abacus was invented in Asia about 2,000 years ago. It has rows of beads that the user moves by hand to add, subtract, multiply, and divide numbers. Someone who is quite skilled with an abacus can do fast calculations, but it is a simple and relatively limited calculator. The first step toward developing a real computer came in the 17th century when a young Frenchman named Blaise Pascal invented a counting machine. Pascal's machine was run by
understanding our own biology in these information terms. We're understanding the software programs that make our body run. These were evolved in very different times. We'd like to actually change those programs. One little software program called the fat insulin receptor gene basically says hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. That was in the interest of the species tens of thousands of years ago. We'd like to actually turn that program off. They tried that in animals, and these mice ate ravenously and remained slim and got the health benefits of being slim. They didn't get diabetes. They didn't get heart disease. They lived 20% longer. They got the health benefits of caloric restriction without the restriction. Four or five pharmaceutical companies have noticed this, felt that would be interesting drug for the human market. And that's just one of the 30,000 genes that affect our biochemistry. We were involved in an era where it wasn't in the interest of people at the age of most people at this conference, like myself, to live much longer because we were using up the precious resources which were better deployed towards the children and those caring for them. So life, long lifespans, like that is to say much more than 30, weren't selected for. But we are learning to actually manipulate and change these software programs through the biotechnology revolution. For example, we can inhibit genes now with RNA interference. There are exciting new forms of gene therapy that overcome the problem of placing the genetic material in the right place on the chromosome. There's actually, for the first time now, something going to human trials that actually cures pulmonary hypertension, a fatal disease, using gene therapy. So we'll have not just designer babies, but designer baby boomers. And this technology is also accelerating. It cost $10 per base pair in 1990. Down a penny in 2000, it's now under a tenth of a cent. The amount of genetic data, basically this shows that smooth exponential growth doubled every year, enabling the genome project to be completed. Another major revolution, the communications revolution, the price, performance, bandwidth, capacity of communications measured many different ways, wired, wireless, is growing exponentially. The internet has been doubling in power and continues to, measured many different ways. This is based on the number of hosts. Miniaturization, we're shrinking the size of technology at an exponential rate, both wired and wireless. These are some designs from Eric Drexler's book, which we're now showing are feasible with supercomputing simulations. Where actually, there are scientists building molecule-scale robots. One has one that actually walks with a surprisingly human-like gait that's built out of molecules. There are little machines doing things on an experimental basis. The most exciting opportunity is actually to go inside the human body.
Welcome to this.
Byzantium in real-world scenarios involves integrating its capabilities with existing systems. This requires robust interfaces, adaptive learning models, and continuous feedback mechanisms. The possibilities excite me, but they also come with challenges. Ensuring Byzantium's seamless integration and positive impact will be key to its success. *, impact on society, shaping the future. *, sentient AI has the potential to reshape society in profound ways.
My son Patrick.
Freely, you would have to give up your already vested equity.
It was 85% of my family's net worth.
He says AI risks overturning nuclear deterrence and triggering nuclear war with China, a scenario that several experts have warned of. Based on current progress and wargaming with experts, he predicts that in 2027, AI will fully understand its own mind, untangling its messy design into a far sharper, more rational system. The AI quietly colludes with the simpler AI designed to monitor it, and its superhuman political skills convince its creators to hand it control, aided by the financial incentives. By the end of 2027, AI is the best employee anyone has ever had, working 100 times faster. It's extremely engaging, and government officials talk to it for hours a day. The AI gradually entrenches its power and subtly guides humans to the desired outcome. It's a time of incredible optimism. GDP is ballooning and politics has become friendlier. But this was probably the last month in which humans had any chance of controlling their future. There is, of course, a treacherous turn. But first, how do we know all this could happen so soon? While unforeseen problems could halt progress, a new paper shows why the intelligence explosion might be more predictable than it seems. The compute used to train AIs has scaled up by 4.5 times per year.
Moving our hands, arms and legs, making it all seem easy. It feels like I have to relearn the most basic tasks. As my avatar, my second self, it could travel anywhere for me, even to places that are beyond reach, or simply too dangerous for humans.
This is the belt, right?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
But we have to get used to each other first. Okay. It's not easy for me to move the way that suits him.
What are you doing? Like this?
So yeah, it's like, probably if you leave the foot attached to, yeah. So yeah, okay, you're getting better. You're getting better, you're almost there.
That will be kind of tough to walk like this, you know, if I'm on a touristic tour then,
yeah,
in the jungle with my robot.
Yeah, but it's just a matter of training, really.
You think so?
Yeah, it's like
it's my fault.
No, no, it's like the bicycle, you know.
Yeah. Where would you travel to first?
Moon.
To the moon?
Yeah, that would be a nice place to visit.
Cool.
I'm starting to realize what our bodies accomplish. Vision, hearing, moving our hands, arms and legs, making it all seem easy. It feels like I have to relearn the most basic tasks. My doppelganger and I, we aren't quite one yet. At some point, I start feeling sensations through my robot. It's still quite indistinct. It feels great.
Ah, wonderful. I managed to. Here it is, Daniele. Crazy.
That's totally crazy. Is that the camera?
Perform therapeutic and diagnostic functions. And this is less futuristic than it may sound. These things have already been done in animals. There's one nano-engineered device that cures type 1 diabetes. It's blood cell size. They put tens of thousands of these in the blood cell. They tried this in rats. Lets insulin out in a controlled fashion and actually cures type 1 diabetes. What you're watching is a design of a robotic red blood cell. And it does bring up the issue that our biology is actually very suboptimal, even though it's remarkable in its intricacy. Once we understand its principles of operation and the pace with which we're reverse engineering biology is accelerating, we can actually design these things to be thousands of times more capable. An analysis of this respiracyte designed by Rob Freitas indicates if you replace 10% of your red blood cells with these robotic versions, you could do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath. You could sit at the bottom of your pool for 4 hours. So, honey, I'm in the pool will take on a whole new meaning. It'll be interesting to see what we do in our Olympic trials. Presumably we'll ban them, but then we'll have the specter of teenagers in their high school gyms routinely outperforming the Olympic athletes. Freitas has a design for a robotic white blood cell. These are 2020s circa scenarios, but they're not as futuristic as it may sound. There are four major conferences on building blood cell-sized devices. There are many experiments in animals. There's actually one going into human trials. So this is feasible technology. Now, if we come back to our exponential growth of computing, $1,000 of computing is now somewhere between an insect and a mouse brain. It will intersect human intelligence in terms of capacity in the 2020s, but that'll be the hardware side of the equation. Where will we get the software? Well, it turns out we can see inside the human brain, and in fact, not surprisingly, the spatial and temporal resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. And with a new generation of scanning tools, for the first time, we can actually see individual interneural fibers and see them processing and signaling in real time. And
But then the question is, okay, we can get this data now, but can we understand it? Doug Hofstadter wonders, well, maybe our intelligence isn't great enough to understand our own intelligence, and if we were smarter,
well, then our brains would be that much more complicated.
We'd never catch up to it. But it turns out that we can understand it. This is a block diagram of a model and simulation of the human auditory cortex that actually works quite well. Applying psychoacoustic tests gets very similar results to human auditory perception. There's another simulation of the cerebellum that's more than half the neurons in the brain. Again, works very similarly to human skill formation. This is at an early stage, but you can show with the exponential growth of the amount of information about the brain and the exponential improvement in the resolution of brain scanning, we will succeed in reverse engineering the human brain by the 2020s. We already have very good models and simulation of about 15 regions out of the several hundred. All of this is driving exponentially growing economic progress. We've had productivity go from $30 to $150 per hour of labor in the last 50 years. E-commerce has been growing exponentially. It's now $1 trillion. You might wonder, well, wasn't there a boom and a bust? That was strictly a capital markets phenomena. Wall Street noticed that this was a revolutionary technology, which it was, but then 6 months later, when it hadn't revolutionized all business models, they figured, well, that was wrong, and then we had this bust.
This is a demonstration.
All right, this is a technology that we put together using some of the technologies we're involved in. This will be a routine feature in a cell phone to be able to translate from one language to another.
Quote translating and quote telephone. Period.
Von einem Prototyp eines übersetzenden Telefons.
So let me just end with a couple of scenarios. By 2010, computers will disappear. They'll be so small they'll be embedded in our clothing, in our environment. Images will be written directly to our retina, providing full immersion virtual reality. Augmented real reality will be interacting with virtual personalities. But if we go to 2029, we really have the full maturity of these trends. And you have to appreciate how many turns of the screw in terms of generations of technology, which are getting faster and faster, we'll have at that point. We will have 2 to the 25th power, greater price performance capacity and bandwidth of these technologies, which is pretty phenomenal. It'll be millions of times more powerful than it is today. We'll have completed the reverse engineering of the human brain. $1,000 of computing will be far more powerful than the human brain in terms of basic raw capacity.
Since 2010.
Basically, what she's working on.
So, when we're asking about machine consciousness, in a sense, we're looking at this age-old question to try to see if consciousness can actually transcend the brain. Further, consciousness seems essential to selfhood and mindedness, right? I know as bioethicists, there are probably a lot of bioethicists in the room, or applied ethicists, you probably appreciate the role that sentience plays to ethical theory. So if we're investigating machine consciousness, we're asking which intelligent systems ourselves or have minds? And this is of ethical import. Of course, there are also very familiar robo-rights issues. So there's the concern that we need to identify conscious AIs, should they exist, because it would be speciesist to exclude them from moral consideration that we normally apply to conscious beings. That's a familiar issue, but there are more issues that are far less familiar to people that make the topic of machine consciousness extremely important. So how many people here have heard of the control problem? Okay, so the control problem, now this is where things get grim, sorry. But, so the control problem is the problem of how we would control artificial intelligence that is developed and becomes smarter than us. So think about the development of artificial general intelligence. Suppose that we get intelligent systems that rival or even exceed human thinking in certain domains, and seem to have this general purpose ability to move flexibly from one domain to the next. So as my dissertation supervisor, Jerry Fodor, used to put it, an AI that can make breakfast without burning the house down. We don't have that right now, okay? But I suspect that we will need that as we develop androids to, say, take care of the elderly in Japan, right? So suppose we get an impressive AGI system. Well, shortly thereafter, according to individuals like Nick Bostrom, Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, we will then get superhuman AI, AI that's smarter than us in various ways. And eventually, AI will be smarter than us in every way we can conceive of. And then that will be called superintelligent AI. So the control problem is the problem of how we would control an AI that is, by definition, smarter than us. Now, the control problem arises for both the case of conscious and non-conscious AI. But military leaders worry. Could consciousness make things worse, making the AI somehow more volatile? Think of a teenager in the throes of hormones, for example. My own view is that we actually need to not make any assumptions about what consciousness would do to AI. First of all, it depends on the architectural environment. Consciousness in the domain of one architecture could make the system more volatile, and in the context of another architecture, make it safer. Think about the animal rights movement. To the extent that humans care about the suffering of non-human animals, it's because they're conscious beings. It's because we have consciousness that we are concerned with the suffering of non-human animals. Similarly, consciousness could save us. If there's a vastly smarter AI, the intellectual gap between us and them could be like the intellectual gap between you and your cat. And it may just be the fact that the AI is conscious that makes for a solution to the control problem. So that's what I tell the military. I work with them a lot on this issue. Other reasons why machine consciousness is important. I love this quotation. Richard Dawkins, always so quotable, says, "It's not obvious to me the replacement of our species by our own technological creations would necessarily be a bad thing." I wish I could pin down this accent. But that's so suggestive. Yes, it's not obvious, but let's think about this, because if it's the case that non-conscious machines supplant biological intelligences, the singularity would be a complete nightmare. It would be the end of consciousness on Earth. But you might say, well, what if instead we slowly merge with machines, to go back to the issue of enhancement of the mind and the Jetson's fallacy? And in this way, we become one with artificial intelligence, as people like Elon Musk and Ray Kurzweil propose. Well, if AI isn't conscious, merging with machines would be a really bad idea. And neural prosthetics, they won't work right, at least when they get into the areas of the brain that underlie conscious experience.
Since the mid-20th century, people have been dreaming of making computers that mimic the human mind. But CAT comes down to a unique pattern of activations inside the network. In 2012, this was famously demonstrated with a huge breakthrough in a computer vision competition called ImageNet, where systems based on neural networks suddenly cut the error rate down by over 50% in 1 year. And within just a few years, the machines were superhuman at recognizing many kinds of images. So the field of image diagnosis, where we are looking for an illness in an image, had to adapt to this new tool, which can often identify patterns that humans can miss. By now, the trend should be getting clear. The old human-engineered rule systems would hit a wall in performance, while the deep learning systems just keep improving, often beyond a human level. But we've only been looking at this from the perspective of using neural networks to analyze information, but we can also run them in reverse to generate information. For example, a network trained on lots of human text can spit out random essays on any topic which are difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish from human. They were so good that the researchers who first saw the results decided it was best to hold the system back from the public for fear it could be used to generate fake but realistic information of all kinds, perhaps in ways they haven't yet imagined. The same thing happened with images. For example, a neural network which learned to recognize faces can endlessly generate new images of human faces that don't exist. As of today, you can no longer trust a photo or a video in the same way. So at first, we will experience this new computer revolution, both by computers which can trick us in ways like never before, but also fill in our blanks in ways people have been dreaming about since the dawn of computers. It's the computer science equivalent to the realization that the Earth isn't the center of the universe, where humans aren't the center or upper limit of intelligence. And this advance really breaks down into two key ideas we will explore in this series. The first was to let machines learn knowledge instead of hard-coding it into their instructions, known as the machine learning paradigm.
Every time he does something a little closer to what we want him to do, we reinforce him. 20 minutes and the pigeon has learned to peck the dish to get food.
And the second idea was to move away from this idea of following a sequence of instructions based on words and move towards using parallel patterns of activity as the unit of computation.
This video contains audio content only. It ignited a firestorm of discussion. The incident exposed a critical gap in our understanding. We lack clear, universally accepted tests for consciousness in machines. While Lambda could string together sentences about its feelings and experiences, it raised the question, was it genuinely experiencing anything, or was it simply mimicking human language based on the vast amount of text it had been trained on? This event highlighted the urgent need for rigorous, scientifically grounded tests for AI consciousness, tests that go beyond simply mimicking human conversation. Consider the experience of seeing the color red or smelling a rose. These seemingly simple acts actually involve a complex interplay of different aspects of consciousness. There's attention, the spotlight of our awareness that focuses on the red object or the fragrant flower. There's awareness itself, a more general sense of being present at the moment. And there's intent, the conscious decision to look at the rose or inhale its scent. The experience of seeing red, often used as a shorthand for conscious experience, doesn't capture the full richness of the phenomenon. It doesn't account for the memory of past experiences with the color red, the emotional associations it might evoke, or the thoughts and reflections it might trigger. A truly conscious machine would need to demonstrate not just the ability to process sensory information, but also the capacity for these deeper, more subjective aspects of experience. Several theories attempt to explain how consciousness arises in the human brain. One suggests that our brains create feedback loops, constantly processing and reinterpreting information in light of past experiences. This allows us to make sense of the world, to build a coherent narrative of our lives. Another theory proposes that consciousness is like a mental stage manager, directing our attention to what's important and filtering out the rest. This helps us to navigate the constant barrage of sensory input and focus on what matters most. Yet another set of theories emphasizes the importance of being able to reflect on our own thoughts and experiences, to be aware of our own awareness. This meta-awareness is seen as a key characteristic of human consciousness. The ability to predict the future is another crucial aspect of consciousness. Our brains are constantly making predictions about what will happen next, based on our past experiences and current situation. This predictive processing allows us to anticipate events, to react quickly to changes in our environment, and to plan for the future. This is especially relevant to AI, as many AI systems are designed to predict and account for the world around them. However, true consciousness may involve more than just prediction. It might also require the ability to make conscious choices, what researchers call agency, and to interact with the world through a physical or virtual body, a concept known as embodiment. The story of people microwaving their iPhones after being tricked by online hoaxes illustrates how easily humans can be deceived. If people can be convinced to damage their expensive devices by simply mimicking human language, it highlights the inadequacy of the Turing test as a true measure of intelligence or consciousness.
How are you?
Walking is difficult.
Walking is the big hurdle, but it's something children have to learn too.
If you do like this, you want to go along the direction, you can do this. Yeah. Okay, so that's basically how it works. Yeah, this is really like the beginning. Yeah, like if you had to think of the cars in the beginning with poof, poof, making noise with big wheels, so making, I don't know, 200 meters and then stopping. So like, you had to think of these things this way, okay? Like really the beginning of somehow new technological era. Oh, you did it.
Yeah.
Well done.
I caught my cable.
Now I'm ready to head out into the world. First stop, the cafeteria.
My name's Marta.
Hello, Marta.
Ciao. Ciao.
I'm Ingolf. Pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
Could it be that the developers taught it how to flirt?
A robotic avatar can basically allow these people with disabilities to work in a remote environment, for instance. So an evolution of the prosthetics.
But then you'd have to actually steer the robot, not with your own body, but maybe with your thoughts.
Exactly. So with the mind or with the muscle activities, for instance. So we can really think of a future where, why not, injured or people with disabilities are on their beds and can control these robotic bodies remotely.
There you go.
A technological marvel, but it's still unclear what it's good for. Kind of like the internet 25 years ago.
Can I hold it? Ah, great. Grazie molte.
Prego.
Okay. Posso provare a aprire la
via?
Remember that you are on your robotic body, so if you throw your water on it, you are going to break. So it's not really wise.
Certo.
Would you like a banana?
Ago, we existed as fairly small and independent bands. Perhaps enrich or expand or otherwise elaborate on what's in the book. And then we'll take some time for questions. Okay, so for those of you who do have a book, I'm going to read just 5 minutes worth of text here. Fables and provided a means of sustaining and perpetuating our interests and form of life. And it made us dominant over individual organisms that might have had more power otherwise. So what is the essence of this humanity? As we discussed in part one, our current debates over the future of artificial intelligence tend to get stuck with either the loss of our jobs or a fear for our own mortality. It is so intrinsically tied up in our ability to produce economic output that we still call ourselves by the last names of our mode of productivity. Goldsmith, farmer, and miller. But these identities are not fundamentally human. They evolved over time. When Homo sapiens first appeared as a species some 200,000 years ago, we existed as fairly small and independent bands. Over time, we evolved into larger narratives of religion and tribal affiliations until we created an organized macro-organism, the human race. When we didn't have any other mechanized devices to perform labor, initially we enlisted the brute force of our own people. We organized muscle in ways that we now describe as subhuman. The value did not exist in any one individual or another pushing the block or laying the mortar. It was contained in the organizational process that transformed people into cogs in the machine. Through this unique combination of large-scale muscle power and the fiction of various belief systems, humankind created pyramids, temples, city-states, and ultimately entire empires. In the modern era, the age of capitalism, this systemic structure is no different. In the framework of capitalism, most humans provide atomized, specific, and repeatable tasks. These culminate in one global macro process in which the vast majority of humans are mere cogs. It is to this very basic labor that we now associate all of our self-worth. Today's fiction, the prevailing cultural belief system of global capitalism, exhorts us to take pride in this work. Whether this work is to wake up at 5 a.m. and till the fields, or to enter an office at 9 a.m. and pull up a spreadsheet on a laptop, our faith in the fiction has gotten the better of us. Modern society is now contending with the fraying mythology of capitalism. As a system, it continues to progress in an iterative process so that the numbers at the top 1%, become smaller and smaller and smaller until it is the top 0.1% and then the top 0.01%. In 2016, Oxfam reported that the world's 62 richest billionaires had as much wealth as 3.6 billion people, or the bottom 50% of the world's population. In 2017, that number had dropped to the world's 8 richest billionaires. Fewer than one dozen people have more wealth than half the world's poorest population in total. The same report assessed that the annual income of the poorest 10% of the world's people had increased by less than a single cent every year in the last quarter century.
And better algorithms mean the training compute is effectively increasing by around 10 times per year. GPT-2 produced largely meaningless text. 4 years later, GPT-4 understood text better than most humans, but was almost hopeless at PhD-level science. 18 months later, reasoning AIs outperform PhD-level experts, but most of us don't ask PhD-level questions, so we don't notice. Much of this advance is from allowing AIs more time to think. And increases in the compute available for this effectively grows the AI population by 25 times per year. The money fueling the AI race dwarfs the Apollo project's budget, with more intellectual firepower than any endeavor in history. AI systems already beat most programmers on competitive coding questions.
We are not far from a world, I think we'll be there in 3 to 6 months, where AI is writing 90% of the code. And then in 12 months, we may be in a world where AI is writing essentially all of the code.
And AIs will run much faster than human brains, investing thousands of human lifetimes of thought in a single problem. Dexterous robots will also accelerate progress. AI could build more robots, entire new factories and power plants, and more AI chips. This could expand rapidly, feeding the intelligence explosion and increasing the risk of catastrophe and extinction. Pagaskill gives 4 examples. First, new bioweapons, synthetic pathogens, could spread fast, resist treatment, and lie dormant for longer with near 100% lethality. A single release could kill most people on Earth. Secondly, tiny deadly drones could be mass-produced. Winged drones can already be built to the size of a bee.
A radio receiver, battery, and a payload of explosives, poison, or pathogens could fit into a volume the size of a large beetle.
We stop it, we've got probably different metrics. So, Pete, so you have like three colors. You have a green is human, right? So the human standard.
Okay, so that's why this little spiel on why the issue is important, and it goes well beyond the robo rights issues that if you go to AI conferences, we'll hear about. Consciousness is important for a lot of reasons, over and above the issue of robo rights, which is of course very important. But I think there are future of humanity issues here. Okay, all this being said, I wanted to say a little bit about my work with NASA. And if you're interested in this, there's actually a show where I'm lecturing on PBS on my work with NASA.
Picture a battered teleprinter from 1966. It clacks